free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Hello, everybody. This is the Free Energy Now show. This is Ryan Hageman from Deluge Inc. I'm your guest today, and I'm also filling in for Sterling, who is en route to his phone. As soon as Sterling Allen gets on the phone, he'll be calling us in. Sterling Allen is from the New Energy Congress, has been running Free Energy Now show on the radio for internet radio for quite a while. Myself and Jim Valentino from Deluge are on the phone today, being interviewed by Sterling as soon as he gets here. But we're going to try to fill in for him. And the show was about our new thermal hydraulic engine called the Natural Energy Engine. And we're just going to get through the next hour until Sterling gets here. Jim and I both love to talk, so I think we can fill up an hour, no problem. Jim?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jim Valentino, as Brian said. And hopefully we'll be filling you in on probably one of the newest, most innovative, but more than that, highly impactful alternate technologies that you might have heard of recently.
Thanks, Jim. I've got a few questions here that Sterling was going to propose, or at least ask me to be ready for. So I'm just going to go through a few of these questions, and we'll talk about them. One of the first questions is, how does the technology work? A bit of an overview of our technology. It's called the Natural Energy Engine. You could see it running if you want to take a look at it on our website at DelugeInc.com. That's spelled DelugeInc.com. I think we have Sterling. Is that Sterling?
Yeah, Sterling here. Sorry about that.
That's fine, Sterling. We started without you the last couple of minutes, and I introduced myself.
Great. I appreciate that. Okay. Excuse my flakiness. Apparently, Vonage is not able to call into this conference call thing. I've not had a problem with it in the past, but today it wasn't letting me in.
So you found it online, and you're in. Thank you, Sterling. I appreciate it. I was going to start talking about how the technology works, but please, Sterling, maybe you can lead us in a little bit to tell your story today.
Well, actually, that's where I like to start is, you know, how does the technology work? And Septic is as place as any to go ahead and launch. So why don't you go ahead and keep on going of your initiative. I appreciate that.
Well, Sterling, we'll do that and just jump in with any questions you have, and Jim Valentino's on the line too, and the technology part, I'll take that. Jim likes to leave most of the technology talk to me or my chief engineer, Mick Furman, working with us. But the technology itself is a fairly simple idea. It just hasn't been used in engine development as much as it needed to be, that's for sure. It runs on expansion of liquids. We've all seen engines that run on expansion of gases, whether it's a steam turbine or a Stirling engine, but we haven't looked at how does expansion of liquids work as a substitute for expansion of gases. Most engineers, physicists in the past 50, 100 years have found that the expansion coefficient of most liquids, especially water, is insignificant. It's about 1% over a 100-degree temperature range, and it hasn't been looked at as significant enough to build an engine that would be cost-effective. They knew it could happen, but with, what we've developed is beyond water or oils. A lot of different working fluids have a different coefficient of expansion, and that provides our power drive that pushes pistons. We use liquefied gases. We found liquefied gases have got a huge coefficient of expansion, liquid CO2 being the most plentiful, available, and cost-effective as a working fluid. So we expand and contract liquid CO2, and it always stays in its liquid form, never changes phase. although it does go through the supercritical point of liquid CO2 as it rises up and down through its temperature range. And to explain it on the radio in a simple thought, everybody knows what a thermometer looks like, how it operates. It's a capillary tube with a reservoir on the end full of liquid, quite often mercury. As that liquid changes temperature, it changes size. So if you add heat to the reservoir of mercury, it changes size, and it changes exactly the same size with every rise in temperature. So they can calibrate it in a thermometer, and you can see the rise and fall of the liquid expansion. And that's exactly what we use, and just stick a kind of a piston in the end of a giant thermometer, and the liquid goes up and down and pushes the piston. Now, again, mercury, water, oils expand and contract maybe 1 or 2%. Liquid CO2 expands 50%. So for every gallon of liquid CO2, we create an extra half a gallon. And that half a gallon is displaced through a tube into a piston chamber, a hydraulic piston that is pushed the same as any hydraulic piston is pushed with an incredible amount of force and torque that can be created, converting heat energy from changing the size of the liquid directly into mechanical energy through the mechanical shaft at the end of the piston, Sterling.
Okay, so talking about liquid CO2, and maybe you can help the lay audience here. We think of CO2 as a gas at room temperature. You know, it's in the air. It what is emitted from combustion systems. So you're talking about it in a liquid form. What does it take to get it in liquid? Is it a high, low pressure, higher temperature? What is it? How are you getting that into a liquid state and staying in a liquid state?
Sure. When you buy liquid CO2 at the store, you buy it in a bottle. It looks like an oxygen bottle, acetylene bottle. We buy it, liquid CO2. It comes off the truck at ambient temperature at around 900 PSI. In the bottle, it'll stay as... Actually, a bottle is maybe only about half full of liquid CO2. So at that pressure, 900 PSI, it'll stay a liquid. We build our engine system to high-pressure standards and codes that similar to a Freon compression system, only higher pressure. Freon runs around 300 PSI. We run in the 1,200 to 3,000 PSI. So we build a heat exchanger and piston assembly fully valved with water control valves that can handle that pressure. So we just pour the liquid CO2 out of the bottle into our heat exchanger system at room temperature, and then we actually use a hydraulic pump in line and pump it up even more. So it transfers from 900 PSI out of the bottle into our heat exchanger at 900 PSI, stays at 900 PSI and stays liquid. It's actually, these bottles have a siphon tube, so the liquid is always coming off the bottom and going into our system. And once it's in our system at 900 PSI also, it stays liquid. Then we turn on the hot and cold water, and the pressure will actually rise as the CO2 expands to an operating pressure of around 12 to 1,500 up to 25 to 3,000 PSI each stroke, each cycle. As you turn on the hot water, pressure goes up. As you turn on the cold water, pressure comes back down. So we've got high and low baselines to work from.
Now, what are you? How are you applying these temperature differentials in terms of? Do you have an external heat source that you're running through a chamber, such as a solar heat source or a waste heat? You mentioned geothermal. Do you have like a hot in? And then do you have to maintain a cold to cool it off again? Do you have to have two reservoirs, one hot, one cold?
Yeah, exactly. On our solar tests that I've done in the past, there's a closed-loop hot system, hot water system. There's just a closed-loop hot water system that goes through our heat exchanger. Alternately, there's a closed-loop cold water system that go through either a cooling tower or some of our models spec out earthen coolers, just to dig a hole deep and put steel pipe out, lay it out, and you can create an earthen cooler. Or you can actually use the water that you're pumping as a cooling source. One of our projects that we're looking at in Texas is a big water aquifer water pump system that will pump 500 gallons a minute, and that water that we pump out of the ground is our actual cooling source. It's more than enough, five times more than enough cooling that we need. So, yeah, you need a cooling tower and a solar collector or some other kind of cooling, but we need both. So it takes a little energy to make both of those cycles happen, but our newer model engines pump their own water. It has its internal hot water pump and an internal cold water pump. It pumps each side. As it goes through the heat exchanger, there's a little bit of an overlap. We've got two inlet valves. We've got a hot water valve and a cold water valve on the inlet. They're solenoid electronic valves. And then the valves on the outlet that will send it back to its loop, there's two more valves, a hot water recycle valve and a cold water recycle valve. And those are lagged in timing. So when the cold water turns on, it goes in and starts pulling heat out of the CO2. And you can recycle that back to the hot loop for a while. Maybe 10, 12 seconds, you have a lag where it's pumping cold water back into the hot water side to recycle nearly 85% of our BTUs, Sterling.
Mm-hmm. How much, in terms of efficiency, we talk in other solar systems, for example, a photovoltaic system, I think the record is 40% efficient of converting solar energy into electricity. What is your efficiency in turning solar thermal energy into usable electricity or torque or whatever you're pulling out?
Well, our engine can run off a lot of different kinds of heat sources. We mentioned solar, but it runs off geothermal. If in the case in Wyoming where we tested a crude oil pump, we actually used a one-cylinder engine as an artificial lift, they call it, that lifts that rod string up and down in a crude oil pump, and our hot water came to us out of a direct pressure pipe out of the ground from a geyser geothermal source into our engine, so there's no pump involved, straight into our engine and then out and put into a storage tank. When you have efficiencies like that on your hot water side, we're able to transfer practically 85% of the BTUs into direct mechanical force.
Mm-hmm.
We have losses through the system, of course. Our O-ring seals in our pistons are a friction drag on the pistons, and that's a really tight piston there, piston seal. And mm-hmm. So there's losses there, and there's losses in our heat exchangers, losses in the cooling system, which brings it back down to, in the 20 to 25, 30% range, depending on a lot of things. There's a lot of ways you can design the heat exchanger, our liquid heat exchanger that's more efficient. Our small heat exchangers for small use are very efficient. Some of the larger heat exchangers we have to drop the efficiency on to gain capacity. Engines are going to have a lot of liquid CO2 in them.
Could you put a number of these in a series or parallel, I'm not sure how you describe that, so that, let's say you've got inflowing hot water from a solar source, goes through your system, hasn't cooled off all the way, goes to the next one, cools off further, and meanwhile you've got cold coming in, and so you have two or three that you could be running this through simultaneously with different temperature, hot-cold differentials, rather than just having one system. Does that make any sense to do
that?
Yeah,
we do. And we actually do design for that, especially in some of our electric generation designs that we've got on the board right now. We're designing some electric generators. And we've looked at staging engines that run off of each differential temperature. If it comes in at 180, leaves at maybe 140, then we design an engine for 140 that'll take it down to the 110 degree range. And that can be done. To get the same amount of power out of our engine at a lower temperature, the liquid CO2 reservoir increases quite a bit. So it's the cost effectiveness goes down a little bit. So usually what we design for is a single flow through, and then just try to recycle and heat back up. See, once that heat goes through a few engine, it has to come back up to 180 degrees again. Mm-hmm. So if you just do it from 140 instead of 110, it's easier on the heater, and if you want to expand, just add on more solar or geothermal.
Your heats don't have to go very high in order to make the system operate.
Yeah, our gain is not huge. It's 140 to 180 is what we have to rise Fahrenheit. All the temperatures I talk about are Fahrenheit. Sorry about that for our overseas listeners.
82 degrees Celsius is the same as 180 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're below boiling point, and which is going to introduce, if you get into the boiling point and you've got steam and you've got phase change, is that purpose that you stay below that temperature?
Well, actually, it wasn't on purpose, so to speak. It's just that the first engines I designed that ran off of my kitchen sink was 140 degrees. So I was designing the engine to run at low temperatures when I first started the invention process. That's all it took to create power. So, and it was an easy range to work in for solar guys. The solar development folks around the world are great at the lower temperatures, below 200 degrees, below boiling point. So, just the fact that it ended up as a low temperature engine was more just based on nature and not out of necessity. When we learned how to boil water and make steam and create steam engines, I think that was a little bit more out of necessity too, because when you heat up water, it turns into steam, and they just went with that. If they would have tried it putting a piston in the end of the heater and not turning into steam, they would have found that they can get power out of that too.
Yeah.
But our world went to steam engines 120 years ago.
Well, let's talk for a second about price point. And we've talked about the efficiency. Probably the most practical question is the cost of the system versus the amount of energy you're able to generate. And how does this compare to, say, conventional a coal plant source energy or a gas plant? Price-wise, for the amount of for the cost of the electricity that you're generating off this system,
we've done a lot of case studies on pricing scenarios. Of course, our pricing on every market that we go into is priced for that market, and not because our engine costs that much. You know, we're going to try to get the most out of the cost of our engine as we can, so we compare it to what's out there. Including where we've done the most studies out in the oil fields, in natural gas fields, where the natural gas fields, they need to have water pumping out of each gas well to make these wells survive. They get waterlogged and practically shut off. So we've looked at what would it cost to bring electricity in and install an electric motor system with the old horsehead pump compared to ours, and we're comparable. We comparably price ourselves on purpose to the existing technology. And if you're going to do one well out in a rural area in Louisiana, let's say, it would be with electrical brought in, probably in the range of $35,000. So we priced in the mid-20s for the same system. And, pumps the same amount of water out of the gas wells and keeps them running. That's our first target market, actually, is the natural gas industry, and we use the natural gas to run our hot water here.
Basically. Brian, it's Jim. On that comparison, though, you might want to elaborate that while that cost is reasonably comparable, the operating cost differences are dramatically
different. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly, Jim. It's yeah, our operating cost is just 600 cubic feet of natural gas per day that runs our engine with its own internal alternator. And you don't have any electric cost, which is quite often a hefty part of adding on that cost to the cost of producing natural gas right now. It starts to zero out. They don't make enough money to pay for electricity on these things.
So then what happens is we start looking at a return on investment or a break-even point sometimes in under a year for the new technology.
Yeah, 9 to 18 months, depending on the production of the well. That depends on the formations underground. But that, we've done a lot of study in that area. We've done some study in desalination, where if we went into an existing desalination system and replaced their electric motor, which is the huge cost of desalination right now is the electric motor that runs the high-pressure pumps. If we replaced it with one of our engines, the return on investment, again, is in the 10 to 14 months just on electricity savings. So we price per, you know, towards the market that we're going into and not just try to build engines and see this is what we can sell them for.
In a desalination scenario, what is your energy source going to be? What is your heat source?
Well, we've got things on the drawing board. We've done some tests in desalination, completed some tests with the Department of Interior, proving that we can pump a liter a minute of water the same as an electric motor system and do it without that electric motor. So we proved that. The large systems that we're looking at, possibly municipal-sized systems, they would run off waste heat off the electric power plant that's sitting on the beach in California. It's their water source would be the same cooling source, and their waste heat off of a big electric power station would be our heat source. That'd be the cheapest way to go. The next best cost would be geothermal, and then after that, solar thermal. And I'm trying to get the solar thermal industry to come up with the low-cost solar arrays that will be most cost-effective for our engine. But the first big desal stations we see just are added on to the runoff the waste heat of the electric power plant.
Mm-hmm. If it's okay, I'd mention that some of the innovative requests that just came in, just two, for example, from Australia. There's a group there, Controlled Technologies. It's probably one of the leading groups in thermal, both thermal storage and the use of large groups of solar arrays. Well, they would like to use this, so they've got the thermal energy stored in various mediums, and what they would like to do is use that energy through our engine to either produce electricity or to purify water out in the remote areas in Australia, agricultural areas, et cetera. That another interesting request and initial analysis, but a lot more has to be done on it, from what the largest ethanol producer in the country of Colombia, and they use a ton of electricity in the production of ethanol in using sugarcane refining. And so in that distillation process, they're looking to replace the electrical engines that are used to produce ethanol from sugar distilling with our engine, with the thought that this is their thought, not ours, that with the engine in place, they could become the lowest cost producers of ethanol in the world using sugar and using our energy, which it remains to be seen, but those are the types of application requests and analysis that are now coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of our market analysis directs ourselves towards taking our technology into existing energy systems that need a technology upgrade and not try to work out on the edges of building solar arrays, you know, different, you know, or a new kind of engine out there. We're you know, attacking right into the heart of energy production and replacing electric motors and lowering the cost of our energy production that we have now is key to sustaining any natural gas or crude oil in the future. With the demand going up so much, we've got to learn how to cut back on fossil fuel use. We've just got it. Our engine can cut back that use by 90% in just about every application we look at.
Where, at what point would you see yourselves coming up with a home power system?
Yeah, we have a lot of people wanting us to look at home power. My favorite is actually the solar-powered Freon compressor. We can compress Freon the same as your Freon compressor that runs off electricity. We do it a little bit different. We have bigger pistons that move slower rather than that little piston that moves really fast inside of your compressor in your Freon system now. But we've already done some bench tests on a 2-ton air conditioner that we could develop the solar-powered, solar-thermal powered air conditioner that would just eliminate that electric need. Of course, everybody thinks, well, why don't we just make an electric generator and run your whole house? And we're working towards that, too. But we're letting, actually, the natural gas industry, again, is kind of helping us lead into that. A lot of the deep well customers, like British Petroleum, BP, they want me to come up with a design for a 10,000-foot deep gas well that they want electric generators on their systems and not a hydraulic or a lift pump. They want to run electric submersible pumps. So we're designing a 5 to 7 kW system for them. And as that sells into that market, it will spin off into the home product. But we're working towards that. It's the electric generation is a little bit more design work than we've done in the mechanical, the street mechanical engineering work that we've done so far.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us an idea? We've gotten kind of I guess we've hinted at it in some of what we've talked about so far. But how far along are you, and how many devices have you built? Are you fully into the commercial stage? Are you still in a beta testing, alpha testing? How many units have you built, installed? Could you give us an idea of your market penetration stage?
Sure. We're starting the commercialization effort. We started last year. We got kind of the green light at a conference when I presented at Hart's E&P, one of the oil and gas industry magazines, does a conference up in Denver every year, and they asked me to present to the group there, and I showed them how we had run our manufacturer's beta units out in the field, 9 engines, for about 2 years, a 1 year of a solid 24/7 work, and then another 6 months at the start and 6 months at the end of wartime. That gave us over 120,000 hours of total runtime on all 9 engines. But when I presented that to the industry, they were ready to buy. So I had been told a year before that, or 2 years before that, the oil and gas industries might need 5 years of runtime before they were satisfied and would start moving forward. But with that presentation, we had companies starting to step up and want to start buying. So we got into the commercial mode, out of the R&D mode and into the commercial mode, and we've got our first couple brochures out that will be on our website here soon that are new products specifically for the natural gas industry for dewatering of gas wells. So that's and we're working with a bunch of small, medium-sized, and large companies that are working through their process of due diligence to ready themselves to make purchase orders. But we have the designs, costs, vendors for all of the internals of the engines ready, and we can supply purchase orders, turnaround with delivery and installation within 4 to 6 months. So that's the point we're at right now, and we're out there trying to start to hire salesmen. If you know any salesmen in the natural gas industry that would like to work for us, we have commission sales contracts, and we're looking for good people in the oil and gas business now to help us start selling, getting in front of the natural gas businesses. We're looking at an office in Houston. We really need to have a presence in Houston. The center of the energy world is in Houston, and we need an office there. So we're actually talking to a couple of the technology incubators out there, Houston Technology Center and one up in the Woodlands, to see where we want to put our office as we start moving into that market. But the reaction we're getting so far is pretty darn good. It's there's over 200,000 natural gas wells in the United States that are all getting waterlogged. The only way we maintain and increase our gas supply in this country is drill more wells. We're drilling wells constantly to keep up with the fact that all wells eventually get waterlogged. And if we can revive these old wells, we can add net some MCF back into the system that were there but just trapped underground. So it's a new market that we're speeding with. At the same time, talks with solar companies in Hawaii, Australia, India, South Carolina, we're trying to develop our engine into those markets as the solar guys are ready. A lot of them are finding that they have to redesign. Some of our small engines only need a gallon a minute of hot water, and they're actually smaller than some of the big tracking systems that the thermal guys like to build right now.
Tell me, Jim, and I don't think we've got a question for the applications we were talking about here. Are various forms of liquid extraction. You know, we've been pumping oil, now we're talking about dewatering gas wells. But there's a body of applications in terms of electrical generation and purification that we haven't really, that we'll be partnering with and still raising other investment dollars with. So right now we're focusing on, you know, a small company can only do one thing very well, and that's what we're focusing on. So that's the area now, but keep in mind that there will be a body of additional applications with additional types of partners.
Right. Now, one question that I would ask is, and the reason I asked this, it seemed that you alluded to it just briefly earlier in one of your comments about a what I would, for lack of better terminology, describe as a potential conflict of interest, namely the gas and oil industry is invested in selling gas for petrol for fuel purposes, as well as for plastics and whatnot. But your technology has the potential eventually of making those technologies obsolete. If we could generate electricity from solar combined with the system, then a person doesn't need natural gas anymore. Can you perceive that that conflict of interest will, where you're starting out tied to the industry, I guess the gas industry, is that going to, you know, are you going to get a loyalty there, so to speak, that would then impair you from going into a direction which would actually work counter to the gas industry?
Well, yeah, exactly. We've put a lot of thought and analysis into where should we try to fit in first. You know, and it's my background is building huge oil refineries, propane butane plants in Saudi Arabia, oil refineries in Indonesia, nuclear power plants in San Onofre, California, and out here in Phoenix, Arizona. I was always into the construction of our existing infrastructure in the energy business worldwide. And what I see is old mechanical engineering that runs all of our energy infrastructure that needs a technology upgrade. You know, just like you wouldn't run an old computer forever, you eventually just every couple of years buy a new computer. It's time for mechanical engineering to go through the same transition that electrical engineering with the advent of the transistor. Everything changed after that. And all the old ways of doing things, yeah, they're gone. We see our technology, and we're being embraced by the energy industries because they see it as a way to get a better bottom line. If they can reduce their fuel usage to produce power, they like that. They want to see this. The utility companies, the energy infrastructure everywhere, including natural gas and crude oil, they want to see this technology move forward because they like to cut their costs of their electric bill by 90% too. Plus,
and Brian, example is the Arizona Utility Committee. You know, you might want to talk about Arizona.
Yeah. Arizona Public Service is has to lead the way because of the environmental portfolio standard that's demanding the buy electricity from renewable sources. But all these companies, including Chevron, when I had a nice talk with Chevron a few weeks ago at a conference, they've got to lower their carbon footprint. They're being told, just like everybody else in the world, that you need to lower your carbon footprint on production of energy. So they're looking for ways, any way they can, to drop that electric bill. And they like our technology. So embracing that we're getting with that industry, and now the folks in solar all over the world that want to work with us, I see it as us needing to move in both directions. One, to upgrade our existing infrastructure that we've got, but then also to start expanding and allow people to become, have their own personal power development. You know, eventually everybody wants to have their own personal power on their rooftops, or a car that runs on, tenth of the gas. Engines everywhere, electric motors everywhere, eventually need to be upgraded. We've had them for too long. 100 years for internal combustion is, without a technology upgrade in that type of prime mover, is way too long. It's time for change.
Yeah, we've not talked about the automobile application. What would you use as the heat source in that scenario?
Well, what I'd love to use, my dream car, is my engine in it, 200 horsepower engine, it will deliver power to the rear wheels better than internal combustion, and it'll run on methane hydrate rods. Basically, natural gas in a solid form is methane hydrate, and a methane hydrate rod about the size of a can of beer would drop into a little slot inside your car and run your car for a month. Keep a pack of those, six pack of those in your refrigerator in the garage to fill up. But that's my dream. But our first automobile engines that we're looking at will run on just straight gasoline. We'll have a little vacuum system that'll vaporize unleaded or whatever the lowest octane you can get. We can run at 60 octane, but we'll vaporize the gasoline and then actually burn the vapors and make hot water in these really neat, super efficient Renai hot water heaters. We're trying to get them to build them small enough for us. The smallest Renai hot water heater, the instant hot water heaters, is still 16 times larger than what we need. So it's a nice fuel-burning car still. I don't think we can get the solar on a car. This is a horsepower that I like. I like at least 200 horsepower through the rear wheels of my car.
So you don't see, well, back to my earlier question that I was calling a conflict of interest, I guess a contradictory interest would maybe be a better terminology for it, where you're helping the oil, gas industry reduce their carbon footprint, so they like your product. But the other guys in the same office are maybe leaning over saying, hey, while you're talking to them, could you see about getting an exclusive so that you keep this technology in this sector so it doesn't go out and start putting us out of business by developing this
And we run into that through the natural resistance of large companies, quite often in the engineering staff. It's we're working with some of the largest Halliburton-sized global energy or oil and gas parts distributors, Ball and Drill, New Wells. And they saw that this is an engine that eventually can reduce the need for their customers to want them to drill and produce oil and gas. They see that, but then at the same time, they see the opportunity for them to reduce their costs. So, yeah, we're very aware of how companies might want to get a hold of our technology and just put it on the shelf. We won't write any exclusive contracts for licensing our technology to distributors that we want to license. We won't sign exclusives unless they're very open to a performance. They'll have performance guarantees along with it. So, but I don't think we're going to need to look at exclusive licensing. There's so many people that want this every time we introduce it. And it has still been to a relatively small number of people that this technology has been introduced. This is probably one of the bigger audiences that we've been in front of to tell that many new people about this technology. It's been kind of under wraps. We've done some press releases mainly for the green energy industry to hopefully get the green energy industry to embrace us, even though we like working with the existing energy infrastructure.
Sterling, our first national press release was only probably about 3 to 4 weeks ago. That's the first time we went out on a national basis to introduce the technology. As Brian said, you know, we did sort of keep it relatively quiet, except within certain sections of the industry, in order that we could make sure that we have what we think we have.
Right. Well, a corollary to my earlier question about the contradictory purposes of the oil versus the renewable sector, do you see that maybe your technology could serve as a bridge, as a transition point for, you know, you establish a good rapport with the oil industry, the gas industry, and they then, for lack of better terms, jump ship from oil to your technology. They're familiar with it. They've been running it in their fields and could kind of just transition out of, we'll still need oil and gas for many, many, you know, decades yet. Just we're using it for our plastics. We're using a lot of other besides burning it. But there is, you know, from gas to renewables, and maybe your technology could be a bridge point for them.
Well, yeah, exactly, Sterling. And we're looking at it as the visionary side of the company, of how long-term, maybe over the next few hundred years, this technology could impact, is that I would say all the energy problems we have in the world are because of an inefficient infrastructure. Our cars are totally inefficient. For every 100 horsepower in your engine, you're only getting 15 to the rear wheels. Your cars are inefficient, the power plants are inefficient, because everything is based on old mechanical engineering. That needs to be upgraded everywhere. So our existing infrastructure needs to be upgraded, and through that, we can make a 100-year supply of oil in the world last for 1,000 years. You know, so we see it as the efficiency is required everywhere, and conservation of natural resources is in the minds of everybody, including all my friends over in Saudi Arabia that sell oil.
You know, Sterling, maybe not a perfect analogy to your point, but close, is that if you look at the abandoned strip of wells that are in the United States that have been abandoned simply because they look at existing wells and it becomes economically not viable to operate them with electricity, and there are estimates that the strip of wells in the States probably could supply anywhere from 30 to 40% of the U.S. oil requirements. You could take this engine and all of a sudden take wells that were previously not economical to run because of their volumes. We don't need electricity, and make those current strip of wells viable again. So if the oil industry or some of the large players decides to say, we can get this oil from American soil and we could do it economically because we won't be paying for electricity in that case, we would be working with the oil industry in that situation. So I think you're right about the ultimate conflict, but between now and the ultimate conflict, there's an awful lot of room to work together.
Yeah, I think if the oil companies that we've been talking to saw it as we're putting them out of business type of thing, because we can get the world off of oil, they would have we would have seen a lot more negative reaction than we're getting. And it's the engineers in that industry, the whole oil and energy industry worldwide has a million engineers working in it. And we need to win the hearts and minds of those guys that are working in the energy industry, in our infrastructure that's out there now, switched over to us, and they'll help push it through all the way to your house. It'll be a green movement that could start within the energy industry and affect everybody. But the larger projects like this, when we pump oil out of the ground or help pull natural gas out of the ground using our technology, people, you know, all over the United States might be using that natural gas that's being run by more cost-effective, more efficient technology. So it's we will get dignity. But we have had in the past, when we made the decision to go into the crude oil production business about 4 years ago, the governor of Wyoming talked me into it. Up in test up at Ramazzi, the Teapot Dome facility that DOE has up in Wyoming. A lot of the folks that are in the more green environmental movement side that we started talking to that we were looking for their endorsement and cooperation would turn around and because we were trying to work in the current energy infrastructure. So we need to help mend that bridge, and it shows a lot of years. Hopefully we'll get to that point, because it's a technology that's truly an upgrade, just like the transistor was in electrical engineering. We need to upgrade our mechanical engineering now. It's just been around too long. We're very used to it, but we need to throw out that internal combustion engine and that steam turbine and come out with a new mechanical engineering technology.
We have an index page on our site at pezwiki.com of a whole myriad of different engine technologies that are far, far more efficient. And yours, of course, is one of those. There are certainly many better ways to do things than what we're doing right now in the internal combustion engine. I do really appreciate you joining us on the show today. Let's get your website out there. We've not mentioned that yet, have we?
Yeah, sure, please. It's www.deluginc.com. That's DELUGEINC.com. DELUGEINC.com. Deluge like a lot of water. When I first got into the corporation here, we came up with a name that meant a lot of water. Deluge is that. So you can go to our website, call us direct at area code 602-431-0566. That's 602-431-0566. But please go to info@deluginc.com. Send us an email. Tell us about what you're doing and what your needs are. And we get a lot of email from all over the world. And we try to keep up with everybody. We've got our priorities set on marketing to the natural gas industry. But we are looking at strategic relationships with partners all over the world to help develop teams for specific products.
Very good. And what about investment interests? If somebody wants to invest in this, what are those avenues?
Well, sure. We're a private corporation, Delaware Corporation. Private corporations are allowed to have investment in their company. Have to follow all the rules of the SEC exemptions, and we do that. We will only talk to accredited investors about it. And if any of your listeners are accredited investors or friends, want to give us a call or email us through info@deluginc.com. We'll tell you about the investment opportunities that range from direct investment into the company to lease financing for our customers. A lot of the folks we're working with right now in the investment world are putting together the programs for lease contracts for our customers to buy engines.
Very good. And is there anything else we... Actually, we have come to the end of our 55 minutes. Again, we've been speaking with Brian Hageman. He's the CEO of Deluge Inc. and Jim Valentino, who's the also with the company. You're also the inventor, Brian. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's technology that I thought up working in Saudi Arabia. I guess that's why I'm stuck with the energy business, with building huge propane plants over there, testing pipelines that filled with water, and we had a problem with pressurizing. It was new pressure created by the sun heating up the water, and I turned that into design and patented it in 40 different countries.
Very good. So you have a good patent portfolio. Very good. We do have coverage of you also at PezWiki.com. You are in our top 100 energy technologies, moving up in the list.
Thank you.
And again, we appreciate you coming on the show, and we wish you success in your endeavors.
Call us anytime. We'd love to come back and give you an update.
All right. Look forward to it.
Thank you.
Take care.
been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.
Doctor, doctor, can you help me? I'm feeling stressed. I cut back medication, the Prozac and the cigarettes. I've seriously considered crying.